Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service.
The podcast exploring the minds, the motives and the money of some of the world's richest individuals.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumhi ekte The Fifth Floor farnak amidi sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. On the morning of August 15th, 2021, people in Kabul received some shocking news.
The Taliban is in control of Afghanistan. The country's president has fled. And Western countries...
As the Taliban moves in, the West moves out. American helicopters busy over Kabul all day today.
Listen, look at the tracer fire in the air. The guns are going off.
Women are already being, you know, killed and shot for breaching rules that have been imposed on what they can wear and on where they can move without a male escort.
3 years on, what is life like for people in Afghanistan? And what happened to those who left? On this episode of The Fifth Floor, I'm joined by BBC Afghan journalist Shakiba Habib and Shoaib Sharifi, who are here in the studio with me. Welcome, both of you.
Hiya. Hiya.
Hello.
So let's start with you, Shoaib. Take us back to that day, 2021. What was your experience like and where were you when Taliban returned to power?
Well, I was in Kabul. It was just yet a normal, exciting summer day. I left home for a craving to return home in the evening to have melon. It was the climax of melon. So in the beginning, in the middle of the summer, it is melon would come from the north. So you leave home with those craving that you would come back home in the evening and celebrate with the melon. So that is how the day was. Say goodbye home and say, I'll bring some melon home. I didn't say I'll bring Taliban back home that day.
Were you surprised by them just marching into Kabul and taking over Kabul? Because they had been going across the country.
Yes, they were almost at the gates of Kabul. Because we have lived in 40 years of conflict, we have had so many situations mm-hmm. that the front line would be at the gates of Kabul for years. Big battalions of the Afghan National Army with all their armaments were there. They mm-hmm. could fight for months. So we were reporting yeah. about it. We knew that there are barriers stopping them there. So we knew they were there, but absolutely were not expecting them in months or at least weeks, because the whole of the Afghan National Army and Security Forces, we're talking about 500,000 of them, yeah. had withdrawn to strengthen the boundaries of Kabul. So yeah. we were confident that we'll be protected. It appears to be even the Afghan president was surprised that he even had started business as usual on that day. When it happened, it was about in the morning, 10 o'clock, that one of my colleagues came and just said that they have entered. And I'm saying, I don't know who you're talking about. I'm in the middle of something. He said, no, they have entered. I said, what do you mean by they? He said, the Taliban. I said, what do you mean they have entered where? Because we have been following the news of X and Y provinces falling. Yeah. So I thought it's yet another district far away from Kabul. And he said, I've got first-hand information that they have entered the first boundaries of Kabul and they are proceeding. Mm. Absolutely, I failed to process what that sentence meant at that time, because immediately everything, all the colleagues that we had, a dozen of female colleagues and male, all some were out on the streets.
Reporting.
Yes, so when you're faced with a situation that it is too big to absorb, to tackle, you really freeze. And I froze.
Wow.
for minutes, I was like, no, yeah, this cannot be true. I was not saying this should not be true and cannot be true. We're not ready for it. And they said, well, I'm afraid they're proceeding.
It is. And as you mentioned, you weren't expecting it. You were expecting to go home and have melons with your family. And I understand that you found yourself wearing the wrong clothes as well. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, on that day, I don't know if I've told you the story. Somehow I had such a festive mood in the morning. I went to my wardrobe and put on the best suit that I would wear in weddings, like so...
Dapper.
Yeah, dapper. The tie. So because I worked in the Taliban's previous regime, having tie was forbidden. Yeah. It was seen the worst, mimicking the Westerners. So I had the tie on. And after I unfroze myself from that news, I looked from my toe to top that, okay, I cannot run out to go and rescue my colleagues because I myself am...
I'm a walking target.
Yeah, this is the wrong day, the wrong outfit I have got. Oh, and you only try to say, oh, this is the last thing to worry about. Yeah. I've got people on the streets who start calling. Thank God communication hadn't stopped.
And Shakiba, for you, you left back in the 90s when Taliban first took power in Afghanistan. How was it watching from London them returning to Kabul?
The immediate feeling was, oh, not again. And as the news sunk in and then as the day passed, and all those memories from the time that I left and before, when obviously I witnessed their arrival in Kabul, so all those nightmares and memories came back. They were just flashbacks going through my mind and coming in front of my face. And then I thought, it's not about me. It's not about my colleagues, and it's not about a group of women. It's about the whole generation. The previous generation, that was me, we kind of suffered in the same way that the new generation, coming generation, will be suffering. We had some sort of hope, and we thought, okay, people are saying Taliban has changed and they are not the same. They will do nothing to stop education, girls' education, or women working. But then we had this hope that slightly faded, obviously. So when times was passing, so we kind of like getting to the reality that this is not the fact anymore, so they haven't changed much.
What did Taliban takeover mean for Afghan people? How did life change for Afghans?
It's the shock of it. It's what everything was so sudden that, as you mentioned, as Shahibjan mentioned, that no one took the time to take everything in, because everything was so sudden, and all of a sudden you realize you have to think of your life and you have to think of your children, your family, and who is left there and who are coming out and what's the situation, who will be caught by the Taliban, who will be left, what will happen. It's just like all the dilemmas and how much a human being's brain can process in one single moment. So you kind of like think about everything, and because I don't have family left in Afghanistan. But then I thought about those people that I knew through my work. They were journalists. They were just normal people. They were singers. They were people who were writing books. And then I thought, what will happen to every single of them?
There was quite a lot of mis and disinformation that it happens during any conflict. If I balance this whole chain, what they brought, the two positive things, 14th August, 13th August, 12th August, every single day, if we go reverse, on average, 300 people a day got killed. In Afghanistan. That includes civilians, Afghan police, the army, and the Taliban. On 15th of August, that was a full stop. 9,000 people would get killed, years of 20 years of Americans' presence in Afghanistan. That really did stop. What they also, in a way, positive entrance of Taliban to Kabul was, previously, any faction that had entered immediately followed looting of people's houses, quite a lot of anarchy around every street that brought quite a lot of killings. On the day they entered, but that didn't happen, they managed to take control quickly, and there was quite a lot of mess and disinformation that the Taliban are going to every house and see if they've got young girls and they will marry them. They will look for whoever have done anything in the past. They're generals, they will be arrested. So there was quite a lot of fear, which turned to be false later. Because we had seen a lot in the previous times, not just the Taliban. We had even the fall of the Taliban in 2001 when the pro American forces entered Kabul, it had lootings. And during the civil war, when one faction handed over Kabul to the other, Kabul was devastated and thousands died. That at least didn't happen. But also what they brought, at least maybe super hard for us in the cities, but in rural areas, they had never seen one quiet night for the last 20 years fighting Taliban under the pressure from the Taliban, from the Afghan army, from the Americans, bombardment from here and there. That did stop, but at a very high cost, I agree with Shakeba, but yeah, the bloodshed of 9,000 losing lives a month has stopped. Yeah.
Shakeba, you mentioned that at first there was hope and there was a lot of talk about this Taliban is different from the Taliban in the 90s. And they themselves said that they have no plan on stopping women from going to school. They said, and this is a quote, they want to have an inclusive government and live peacefully. But have they delivered on any of those promises?
I mean, as the whole international community, everyone knows that they haven't actually delivered on some of these promises. As Shai mentioned, that yes, security is there. But at the same time, I mean, women, the thing is, you know, it's really difficult to find out that what happens to every individual. I mean, individually, how women survive in there and how they kind of like go from one day to another. But it's generally you speak to people and then you find out that they haven't delivered their promises and people have waited for 3 years. And my worry is that we are getting used to the worst and becomes a norm. I remember working in an office here in London before my job with the BBC. And a young person from Afghanistan came and then my colleague introduced me to him and said, look, this is Shakeba. She's from Afghanistan. She's a woman. She has got 2 kids and husband and she works here and she's my boss. And then the guy, he had the shock of his life. And then he looked at me and he said, then where did you study? Where did you learn everything? So I said, yes, I went to school in Afghanistan. I've been through many coups and many change of governments and everything. And he said, I never met any Afghan woman who's working in the office.
Maybe he was right, because what happened in the last 20 years, in fact, in the last 40 years of conflict, there were not schools in rural areas, even before the Taliban, because of conflict, because of already a very conservative attitude towards women. Maybe the man was
wrong. Yeah, and I could see the shock in his face, poor thing, you know, and he was just looking at me, said, and then when he had this moment and he probably he gathered his thoughts and then he said, oh, I'm really pleased and I'm glad that you are here. And I think it's, as I said earlier, it's the generation that's losing, because I think about those women who are my age and then when the Taliban came and then they got married, they had kids. So now their daughters will be going through the same thing. So they suffered. Their education was left halfway. They couldn't pursue their dreams, but now their daughters are the same. And they are actually going through this trauma twice. Yeah. And regardless of what Shaibjan mentioned, that how many dead people we had every day and every month. So probably most of them, they have lost their husbands, they have lost their kids, they have lost their fathers. But then still, this is something else for, because they know that their daughters' futures will be the same like theirs. So,
do we know who led that takeover of Kabul?
Well, if I say I didn't know until my 13-year-old son told me in that first evening of the Kabul takeover, he told me exactly like this. I think you were wrong. You were saying, oh, you with the Taliban are against filming. They don't like mobile phones. They don't like these T-shirts. And I met the Taliban this evening. He came to our neighborhood and he had a mobile phone. He even has a TikTok account. And he even praised my top and said, well, that shirt is nice. And so, you know, short answer is this new generation Taliban, the majority.
Some of them look like hipsters.
Yeah, in the last 20 years. So obviously, a lot of the shock that people had were from the first 20 years back, the Taliban that were there. Still, on the leadership, still some very prominent of the past were still there. But the majority that really took into Kabul were young faces having joined the Taliban throughout the 2 decades of US presence in Afghanistan. And we could clearly see the impact of social media and the new technology, how they were not the Taliban of very narrow information that we had 20 years ago, exposed to all sort of information that were available to other youngsters, in Kabul.
And as you mentioned, you're both journalists, so no matter how confused you were and how you were worried about your own lives, how it was going to change, you had to continue working and reporting. It must have been exhausting. Tell me about it. Tell me about working in those few first days.
I remember being in any change of regime. Unfortunately, Shakeba and I have experienced so many change of regime, we would sound like 100-year-old because of the number of regimes we have witnessed change. Since, and multiple of them that I remember, I was a kid, my mother would have taken us to a bunker when a change of regime would come. You know, all these atrocities would emerge. She would definitely take two things with her, a loaf of bread and our radio, because information becomes so vital and credible source of information, sources like the BBC. And having remembered that, and now I'm at a position being in the BBC, that, well, you also have to protect your colleagues, but also you have this responsibility for millions of people, because they, again, quite a lot of mis- and disinformation is spreading. So that's why we didn't stop for a moment. We continued, obviously, having our mitigations to be safe and secure, to see how we can operate. Because immediately on day two, we realized there was quite a rise into mental health. We introduced a hotline for share your mental health questions, and we brought in a mental health advisor, and most of the callers were women. It was hard for all, but particularly women had their very right worries.
Shakeba, what about you?
So obviously, it must have been much more difficult for Shaib because he was literally there. But for us, it was exhausting. But still, we knew that how important it was for everyone to know that what was happening. I remember it was just a week after Kabul was taken over by the Taliban, and a colleague of mine said, everyone have aged 10 years in a week time. And we were exhausted, but still we thought, okay, this is much needed help and information. And as Shaib mentioned, people were scared. They had the fear, and probably they couldn't tell what was true and what was not true. And then you realize that, yes, this is the time that my job is really, really needed. And beside being a human being, being from that country and going through, and as you mentioned, being through like hundreds of coups and
change of regimes.
Shaib, it must have been really difficult for those BBC colleagues who had to leave, because many of our BBC Afghan colleagues left Afghanistan after this takeover and came to UK. Tell us about their experiences. What did they go through, and what were the things that they needed to adjust to?
There was quite a lot of ambiguities on the ground as well. Until they were in Kabul, every single moment they were living in utter fear. Nothing that they had done wrong, but because it was, well, they were just objective journalists previously. They were not pro or against anybody. But still, they had their very right fears that they had their children, they had extended families. But at the same time, up until 15th of August, they were very well-known people, respected people in the neighborhood, in the community, as individuals, but also as BBC journalists. So coming to the UK, having that deep-rooted life in Afghanistan and leave everything and come to a whole new place from somebody to nobody, nobodiness. It really did take time to adjust, to absorb, and to be somebody in the nobody area. Nobody knows you, not your neighbors, living in the hotels for months, and then having no friends until you connect. Well, for colleagues are not enough. Neighbors don't know you. You don't know the atmosphere around. If you leave home, back home, until you reach the office, you say hi and you're greeted by 20 people on the way, on average, I would say. And you come here that nobody knows you for a right reason. I'm not saying that, but it really is hard to process it, to readjust, to switch something inside your brain to say, this is a new life, accept it, pick up, get its positivity and move on.
Absolutely.
The move on has been really difficult.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Hi, I'm Simon Jack.
And I'm Zing Sing.
And Good Bad Billionaire is back for a new season, now from the BBC World Service.
Every episode, we pick a billionaire and we find out how they made their money.
And then we judge them. Are they good? bad, or just another billionaire.
So who are some of the people that you'll hear about in season two?
The richest comedian ever? Jerry Seinfeld's there.
There's also my personal favourite story, the fashion designer who was once a communist mime. That's Miuccia Prada.
And the people behind some of the biggest companies on the planet. Google, TikTok, for example.
But we are kicking off with a sporting superstar, Tiger Woods.
Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Farnak Hamidi, and in this episode of The Fifth Floor, we are looking back over 3 years of Taliban rule in Afghanistan with BBC journalists Shoaib Sharifi and Shakiba Habib. So what are the current issues you guys are working on at the moment?
We're looking into governance and economy. Poverty has each year been there. How much they have done in the field of governance, accountability to people, and also where we are in terms of economy, how much the Taliban government are delivering to people and where the needs are.
Mm. And we hear a lot about how tourism is back in Afghanistan. I'd like to get your point of views on this, especially you, Shakiba, as a woman. How does that feel?
It was a surprise, but obviously once you're away from a country for the past 24 years, so you think like, it might be right. And as Shai mentioned, the security is there, but we had this really horrible situation of some Spanish tourists being shot at in Bamyan. But we don't know, obviously. We don't know who is responsible. But the thing is, I hope those people who can travel to Afghanistan bring back the positives of it and show it to the world. And if this becomes some sort of income for Afghans, why not? Mm. And I hope the government is looking at it and kind of like trying to sort things out in that regard. As far as I have seen the videos, it seems that they are welcomed by the locals and there are a couple of tour agencies. So I'm actually looking at it a positive side. So one
thing. A lot of the tourists are also national tourists. So imagine.
So people feel safe enough to travel around.
The people hadn't seen most parts of Afghanistan for 40 years.
Wow.
Your own country is still a different country. You can now go to furthest parts, but I got to be careful and say, if it is me as a man, I can just grab a taxi and go to the furthest parts of Afghanistan. But if it is Shakiba, she needs to have either an uncle, a brother or husband or somebody relative. She cannot go beyond the boundaries of Kabul alone as a woman. You need to have your male
chaperone,
but not for foreign tourists. So foreign tourists, male or female, they do travel. Obviously, they need to have their mitigations of whatever risk is on the ground. But it is the locals believe there's a feeling when you go that perhaps tourism is the savior of Afghanistan economically.
And still no country has recognized Taliban as the official rulers of Afghanistan. But what does this Taliban government mean in the geopolitics of the region?
It is a million-dollar question.
Let's crack it here.
I'm glad you said put it in the geopolitics. The fact that the Taliban government is not recognized, it has impacted lives for the ordinary people. Because imagine living in a country, it's not recognized. And you're reliant on your family sending money from abroad. The banking system is so difficult. Literally sending money to Afghanistan is very, very difficult.
So basically cut off from the world.
Yeah, so in a way you're not sanctioned, but you're sanctioned because you live in a country which is not recognized. I just learned last week that Afghanistan was one of the worst passports to have, but now it became to the lowest bottom of the worst passport to travel. Even aid delivery for a country that is not recognized would be difficult because people need to travel to those countries. Living in a country that is not recognized, it's difficult.
And what's next? How do you see the future now? What's next for Afghanistan?
I don't know. How would Shakiba say? I'm a very optimist person. In the middle of the fire, I would say, because we have seen worst.
And you've seen it all. Nothing can shake you.
I have to say, every year at this time, I'm living with the hope that maybe on 21st of March, girls' school will open. And 21st of March is the first back-to-school day in Afghanistan. And unfortunately, each year, I've lost hope, and then again I say, hopefully, maybe next day. And again, I'm strongly thinking positively. I hope this time, a few months down the line, the girls' school will be open. Hopefully, this stability that is on the ground, more investment would come. Hopefully, economically, the country will be in a better situation. but with hopefully not with the cost of the lives of women and girls that has been badly affected and sidelined.
Shakiba?
Well, being a woman, what choice do I have? I mean, I don't know, to be honest, you know, I can only hope in such situations. And the thing is, it really makes me angry sometimes that I cannot go. For example, I can go to Europe and travel without my husband and without my kids. But then why I can't go back to Afghanistan and visit the places that I haven't met? And I'm really, really want to kind of visit Afghanistan before I die, obviously. Mm. I had hope when I was in Afghanistan, the Taliban came the first time. I lost that hope. And I really hope for all Afghan women and girls that they don't be pushed to either leave the country or make a decision in their life that they will regret it. Whatever in their life is, if it's marriage, if it's education, I really hope for that. And I can only pray for that. So
I hear you. And now 3 years on, what about the Afghan team? It's like, you know, you have your colleagues who've moved here. I'm sure all of you have come together to, you know, make their experience a bit easier because you've been here, you're Certainly. Established. How are things right now?
I think we have always, it has been difficult to disconnect from some very strong Afghan social values throughout. But there are times it could be hard. There are times it is really helpful to stick to them. Shakiba earlier said 3 years of back-to-back coverage and a country under quite a lot of focus, and the whole building of the BBC was on demand, and we had to not only serve our own audiences but also to serve the world. So it was a difficult task, but I thought, okay, what can really help bring us together? We almost 3 years since the Taliban and colleagues coming to London, we threw a party. It was an aid party, and we took refuge into Power of Dance. And the party started with only single poor man on the dance floor, and that was me. And it was so unprecedented to see a senior news editor dancing. I was not dancing for them, but I was enjoying myself. And I was believing, I have to say, Farhana, into the power of dance, that it draws. It draws the hardest, the strictest. And the two and three and four and five.
I saw the video. That was a serious dance floor. There was like... People were throwing shapes there.
Yeah, we had one colleague who said that for the first time in his life that he joined and even didn't know why he joined the dance floor. We had almost 6 hours only talking about ourselves, love and laughter and a lot of dance. And we really got revived, and hopefully we still have that vibe.
Thank you both, Shakiba Habib and Shaib Sharifi from BBC Afghan. That's all from me, Farhana Amidi. The Fifth Floor team was Caroline Ferguson and Alice Joya. The sound engineers were Gail Gordon and Tim Heffer. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Krassi Twig from the Global Jigsaw podcast, where we are asking, why are the Taliban fixated on women? 3 years after the group took the capital, Kabul, women in Afghanistan have been erased from public life. Some UN officials wanted to be recognized as gender apartheid, but the international community is divided and lacking in leverage. The Global Jigsaw looks at the world through the lens of its media. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.